Awesome. All right. I'm Paige. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm honestly so grateful to be here with you guys today. It's truly a privilege. And I was asked to come up with the topic, and one of the things just struck me was, what my life looks like in my hands and what my life looks like when I put it in God's hands. So I'm going to be talking around the idea of in God's hands, and also the peace and the serenity that can be found when I live my life in that way. But we got to kick it off with, like, what's it look like when I got it in my dirty little mitts? You know what I mean? What's it look like when I'm running the show? And when I got here, I didn't know what it meant to be an alcoholic. And I sure as heck did not have any clue what it meant to be living life based on self-will. I had no conception of that whatever. And I'll probably, not I'll probably, I definitely will be doing this in the style of a big book bounce around. And if you're not familiar with that format, that's completely reasonable because it's a format that I just made up. It's a little like a foundation meeting with no foundation. It's unhinged. And so what we're gonna do is we're gonna bounce around the big book, and I'll share my experience, strength, and hope. Now, if you don't have your book to hand, don't you worry. I will read it. I won't reference something I don't read. I'll read it. So don't you worry if you don't have it. But if you have your book to hand, let's bounce around together. And the first place that I'm going to kick it off is on page 44. It's the start of the chapter, We Agnostics. And the reason I'm going to kick it off on page 44 is what my life looks like in my hands is it looks like it's filled with denial. I show up to a place like this with a room like people with people like you, and I look for the differences. I look for all the ways that I'm different from you. I look at all the ways that I drank differently. I behave differently. I'm not like you, and I don't think I'm better than you. I think I'm worse than you. That's how I show up. I got all these denials, all these andas, all these yeah buts. But you see, on page 44, it made it as simple as it needed to be what alcoholism was. And what alcoholism is. And when I saw it, I couldn't deny what was wrong with me. So on page 44, very first paragraph, it goes on to say, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or I'm an and sort of girl. I'm not even an or, I'm an and. Or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. And that was me. You see, what my life is in my hands, what it looks like is I take a drink of alcohol. And I experience this. I experience peace, ease, comfort, serenity. Anyone else relate? I sure hope so. You know what I mean? I take a drink. I got a solution for life. I don't know about you. Like, I take a drink. I'm 6 feet tall and nobody can touch me. I'm good. Nothing better is, nothing was better for me than a blackout. I love blackouts. I know that's a weird thing to say, but I love not being in myself. I love not being in my own body. But the reality is, what happens for me is I take that drink, I get that ease and comfort. And what sets off for me is that feeling of I need more. And the more that I drink, the more that I have to drink, and I cannot control the amount that I take. And you see, I don't know about you, but I drink and I start to get thirstier. And I need that second drink more than I needed that first. And that fourth drink starts screaming at me until I've had eight. And eight will not relent until I've had 16, and so on and so forth. I've been sharing this a lot lately, mostly because I want sympathy. But the truth is, my stomach stopped handling coffee a couple of months ago. And so I have to resort to tea. And you might be saying, like, there's just as much caffeine in tea as there is in coffee. I don't know if that's true. It doesn't feel true. It sucks. Feel bad for me. But so I start my day with a good old cup of Earl Grey tea. Alcohol is the only beverage where that allergy kicks off. Never, never in my life have I ever had a cup of Earl Grey tea. And then kept slamming them back all day. Not once in my life have I ever gone on a 3 day Earl tea bender. Not once. Not once have I ever drunk all the tea in the house and, like, gone into the pantry and found the chamomile, ripped open the bag and snorted it because it's got to be the same. That's never happened. That's the only beverage that happens with for somebody like me. And you see, what happens for somebody like me is I drink and because I do not have the ability to control the amount that I take. I cross these lines in the sand, and I hurt people in ways I never wanted to hurt people. I do things that I never wanted to do. And, you know, my life becomes one that is absolutely unrecognizable to somebody like me. I don't know about you, but I couldn't look myself in the mirror. I hated who I was. I hated who I became. I hated the things that I was doing. And I thought maybe, just maybe, alcohol might have something to do with it. What would happen to me is I would come to the morning after and I would say, I'm never going to drink again. And with everything in me, I meant it. I meant it. I did not want to drink again. And this is the baffling feature of alcoholism. I needed to stay sober. I had to stay sober. I wanted to stay sober. Every single time I said, I don't want to do it again. I promise I'm never going to drink again. I meant it. I was not lying. But a day, a week, a month, several months down the line, I would get a thought, and that thought would happen in my mind. And it would happen when I am as sober as I am today and my illness is untreated, and that thought would be a lie. But the problem is, I believed the lie. If you don't know what I'm talking about, it looks a little something like, I'm as sober as I am today, my illness is untreated, and I get the thought, this time will be different. I get the thought, nobody will ever know. I get the thought, I'll go out for three drinks. Or I'll go out for 3 days, I'll turn it into a long weekend on my own. You know what I'm saying? It looks like if you were feeling the way that I was feeling, if you're going through what I was going through, man, you'd have to drink too. I'm going to kill myself anyway, so why don't I get drunk? Whatever lie it needs me to believe to take that first drink. You see, that is the hopeless feature of my alcoholism. I need to stay sober, but I can't. I can't. Let's bounce around to page 37. Why? Because I feel like it. And, you know, it's what I do. we'll be more structured here in a bit. But I was just like, you know what? Let's go to page 37. And we're going to go to the second full paragraph when we're talking about our friend Jim. When it says, you may think this is an extreme case. Jim is the guy who had a case of the suddenlies. Anyone here ever get a case of the suddenlies? You're out in the world and suddenly there's a drink in front of you and you're drinking, you know, and you don't even know what happened. Now, you may think this is an extreme case. He put his whiskey in his milk, to which I would read that all the time and be like, ew, that is disgusting. It's got a curdle or something. But then I forget, like, Kahlua and White Russians exist. You know what I mean? Like, I completely forget that. So it can be judgmental. And it says, to us, it is not far-fetched for this kind of thinking, not this type of drinking, has been characteristic of every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences. I was trying to play the tape to the end. I was trying to think through the drink. I was trying to, you know, hold on and put different things in front of me in that first drink. Maybe the love of my family, maybe work, maybe going to the gym, maybe doing some outside help. Outside help is wonderful, but man, it wasn't enough to keep me sober. And it says, but there was always the curious mental phenomenon that parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. Next day, we could ask ourselves in all earnestness and sincerity how it could have happened. And you see what that paragraph is talking about. Has anyone here ever seen the movie Tron? Maybe I haven't. But you know, the thing with the movie Tron is I always imagine those two motorcycles, you know, and keep in mind, you could think of any of the Fast and Furious movies, Too Fast, Too Furious, Too Alcoholic. But I have that imagining of two motorcycles. And what's happening is they're running a race. And the first motorcycle is my sane thought, my sound idea. I don't want to drink. I love my family. I love the people in my life. I don't want to hurt them again. I don't want to destroy, you know, the lives of those around me. I don't want to do it. I want to stay sober. And it's running a race. And that for a little while, it's going to be in the lead. For a little while, it's going. But then I got the insane idea. That could be the other motorcycle. And that insane idea is this time will be different. Nobody will ever know. My problem was drinking with Canadians, but I'm in the UK. No alcoholic there, I'll be fine. You know what I'm saying? The insane idea. And wouldn't you know it, that insane idea, that motorcycle, it's got a turbocharger. It's going. And it will win. I did a talk at another meeting where I talked about the difference between a race car and a race car bed. You know, if you guys have those, you know, for toddlers and their bed's a race car, but it's not going. That's my sane idea. And you see what happens for me when my life is in my own hands, I will drink again. No matter how much I need to stay sober, no matter how much I want to stay sober, no matter how much I have to stay sober, I will drink again. And that is my step one experience. But also deeper than that, there's something else that goes on for me. Now, what happens for me is not limited to alcoholics. Non-alcoholics experience this. But I want to pop us over to page 52, if you don't mind. And we're going to talk about the bedevilments. And see, this is what my life looks like. And heck, this is what my life looks like sober. This is what my life looked like when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was going to meetings and I was just trying to not take the first drink. And I was dying on the inside. Page 52, second full paragraph, when it talks about we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problem. See, this is not my alcoholism. This is my humanity. But non-alcoholics, their human spiritual sickness doesn't lead them to have that first drink. For somebody like me, it fuels that obsession to take that first drink. And so why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. Is this my experience? We were having trouble with personal relationships. Is that my experience? We couldn't control our emotional natures. Anyone ever had those wild swings of emotion? You know, I ever hear this saying, the worst thing about sobriety, or the best thing about sobriety is you get your feelings back, followed by what's the worst thing about sobriety? You get your feelings back. You know, those wild swings of emotion. Couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. You know, for me, it was that depression so bad I couldn't get out of bed. And it says we had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. You know, for me, that anxiety so bad, it felt like somebody was stabbing my shoulder blades. I felt like I was a raw, exposed nerve ending. And for some ungodly reason, the wind was blowing. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. It was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether or not we should see newsreels of lunar flight. Of course it was. I need a solution for this because at best, what I've got is that misery and the suffering and the pain of page 52 until I inevitably take that first drink. That is what my life looks like in my hands. Now let's pop back. I'm going to bounce around. I'm sorry for those of you that just got to page 52. Let's pop over to page 28. And we're going to talk about the second full paragraph. We in our turn, page 28. Second full paragraph, we in our turn sought the same escape with all the desperation of drowning men. What seemed at first a flimsy reed has proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. And that is what I need to do, is put myself in God's hands. And I, a couple of years ago in Calgary, well, 2013, not a couple of years ago, oh my gosh, like a decade. Sorry, I didn't mean to have like an existential crisis like mid-share. But we had a major flood. We've got two rivers. And if you've ever seen like a river at flood, it is that brown gray water. And imagine that I'm in the middle of that water and my feet don't touch the ground. And I am being swept away. And I'm being battered and buffeted against the rocks and the stones and the logs and the debris in that water. And you see, I'm grabbing a hold of anything and everything by my own bare hands, trying to get out of that river. You know, I grab a hold of a rock and then that looks like a relationship. It'll be different. Woo! And we slide away from each other. I grab a hold of all these things like a log, that log of self-reliance. And man, it drags me under. And nothing is working. And I am drowning and I'm going to meetings, but it's not enough. I'm dying on the inside. And you know what happens is I see this reed that's sticking out of the riverbed. And just out of desperation, I grab a hold of that reed. And man, it's a flimsy reed. It feels like I'm going to grab a hold of it. And it's just going to pull right out of the riverbed. And I'm hopeless. I'm gone. I'm downriver. And what's the point? But I grab a hold of it. And as I grab a hold of that with everything that is in me, that reed transforms in my hand to the loving and powerful hand of God, who pulls me out of the water and lands me safely on the river's edge. You know, and I just real quick, I'm going to use the word God. I'm not doing great for time efficiency, so I'm definitely going to use the word God. But when I use that word God, what I want you to know is what I mean by that word is the conception of a power greater than yourself that you are the most open to. That is what I mean when I use that word God. Now let's pop, let's bounce around. We are bouncing today. Let's bounce around. We're going to go to the chapter, how it works, and we're going to pop into page 59. And you see, this is what the third step decision is all about. Page 59, first full paragraph, right when it says half measures availed us nothing, which is rude because I was kind of hoping half measures would at least avail me half, you know, doing some of it. I was kind of hoping I could get something for something, you know, not some, you know, not nothing as a result of some action. Rude. I got to do all of this to the best of my ability. But it says we stood at the turning point. The third step is a decision to grab that reed, to put my hand essentially in God's hands, but I don't know that yet. To grab that reed with everything that is in me, with complete abandon. What does that look like? A decision to dive into these steps, this work out of this book as a way of life, like my life depends on it because it does. This is the turning point for the rest of my life. And really what has happened is alcoholism has driven me to the precipice, this ledge where I'm forced to make a decision. I'm forced to jump. And then it says, we ask. And any time in this book, it says, we ask, that's a prayer. Y'all know there's a sneaky little prayer and how it works. Delightful. But I come to the edge of the cliff and I ask for God's protection and care with complete abandon. And I dive in. I dive in with everything that is in me. I dive. You know, I have this story. And, you know, one of the absolute gifts of sobriety is having my niece and my nephew in my life. You know, they are just, you know, my favorite people. I love them so much. And I've been able to be a part of their life as they grew up. And they're kind of entering teenage and sort of their preteen years. But when they were both toddlers, they would both of them would do this thing. Now, for any parents or grandparents or aunts and uncles or babysitters here at the meeting, they would do this thing. Let me know if it happened to you, where they would climb up on a piece of furniture that was absolutely way too tall. You know what I mean? And then, like in my case, they would climb up on the top of the sofa and they would do this thing and it would be Eddie Page catch and they would die. And what I would have to do is go, whoa, whoa. Don't drop the toddler. And if you're wondering, what is this? That is the coffee that I was able to drink at that time. Toddler was the priority, but I wasn't spilling the coffee either. You know what I'm saying? And I would ask myself, how are they able to dive with complete abandon, just like I'm asked to do? Well, the reason is that they've never been dropped. They've never been dropped. And that's how they were able to dive with that absolute complete abandonment. And that's what the third step is. It is a leap of faith. And I don't know where I'm going to end up. I don't know where I'm going to land, especially when I'm doing that third step for the very first time. When I get here, man, I don't know where I'm going to land. But the truth is where I'm diving into is in God's hands. That's who's catching me. Again, if your higher power isn't anthropomorphized, don't worry about it. But that's just the metaphor that I'm rocking and rolling with today. And so what I want to do is I want to pop us over to page 63. And you see, what I thought for a long time is these 12 steps were about climbing this ladder of success, doing better, being better, becoming more. And no, that's not what I found these 12 steps to be about. What I have found is these 12 steps is an outpouring of more and more of myself to the unconditional love that is God. Let's have a look at that third step prayer here in a sec. We're on page 63, and it is the second full paragraph. We are now at step three. Many of us said to our maker as we understood him, God, I offer myself to thee. See, at the third step, I'm making a decision to work these 12 steps as a way of life, like my life depends on it, because it does. It does. And you see, what am I doing as I do these steps? I'm giving more and more of myself to the unconditional love that is God, but I don't know that. When I'm saying this prayer, I don't know that when I'm starting on my inventory. I don't know that until I look back in the rearview mirror and I see that I've been caught and held with love. And I'm giving myself to God to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. I've made a mess of my life. My life is unmanageable. I'm the jerk that was managing it into the unmanageable position. Anyone, but especially God, is going to do a far better job at managing my life than me. And then it says, relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Relieve me of the bondage of self. What is that bondage of self? Of course, that bondage of self is the hopelessness of my alcoholism, but that bondage of self is my bedevilments. Right before in step three, we have the metaphor of the actor playing the director. And you know, I'm running the show. I think I know how the play's supposed to go. What I'm doing is trying to rest satisfaction out of life. Rest is the root word for wrestle. So I'm using my hands and I am trying to claw happiness out of life. And y'all get a sense that that's not how this works. I have never been able to impose joy in my life. And I've also never been able to get people to do what I think they need to do for me to be happy. And in fact, even when they do it, I'm not satisfied. It's never enough. And so relieve me of the bondage of self, the selfishness, the self-centeredness that is driving that disconnection from God, that is driving that pain, that is driving those bedevilments. Why? So that I can better do God's will. Clear away the stuff inside of me so I can be of help to God. And it says, take away my difficulties, not because they're difficult, chicken difficult. I have this thing with my niece where she's like easy peasy lemon squeezy. And I'm like, difficult, chicken difficult. It's a very nuanced reference that nobody in the meeting would get, but that's how my brain goes. Not because they're difficult, but take away my difficulties so that I can help others. And what I am called to do is go from here and help others. That victory over them, victory, and it's not me doing it, it's God removing it from me, victory over them, may bear witness, help those. That I would help of thy power, capital T, capital P, thy love, capital T, capital L, thy way of life, capital T, capital W. See, if I'm struggling with the word God, could I not start with thy power or thy love or thy way of life? And it says, may I do thy will always. What is God's will for a little old drunk like me to dive into that fourth step, to begin to clear away the wreckage of the things that are blocking me from God? And you know, the most incredible thing happens. As I begin to see more and more of myself that, man, I can't manage on my own. See, I have a look at my resentments. You know what happens? I can't get free of them on my own power. I've got to turn to God. I've got to say the resentment prayer on page 67. And I've got to begin to change my view and see where I was wrong. See, I can't overcome them on my own, but God can. And then I look at my fears and it talks in page 68. We're bouncing. Oh, man, we are bouncing around all over the place. On page 68, it talks about how like self-reliance was great as far as it went, but it didn't solve the fear problem. I can't overcome fear by myself. And there's a promise on page 68. It's in the second full paragraph. And it says, just to the extent that we do as we think he, which is God, would have us, and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity. See, I can't overcome fear on my own, but God can. And then in page 69, I start to have a look at my sex and relationship conduct. And you know, man, I hurt people with how I behave. I hurt people with that selfishness, self-centeredness. And I need to live in a different way, but I can't live up to that no matter how much I want to, no matter how much I need to. And so God takes me there. I come up with the same sound ideal for that area of my life, and I let God take me there. So this is more and more of myself that I'm outpouring to this love that is God. You know, and let's pop over to page 75. I want to talk about, so I begin to do that inventory. I begin to have a look at the stuff. I begin to see myself. And then I carry this inventory and I take it to God and another human being on page 75. It says, it's the second full paragraph. It says, we pocket our pride and go to it. So if you're looking for directions on how to do a fifth step, that's it. Put my pride in my pocket and do it. Do it, regardless of my fears, regardless of what I think, regardless if I don't think it'll work for me. Doesn't matter. Go do it. Do it. And then it says, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the path. That's letting that light in. You know, I love the metaphor of God as light, because light is not what I see. Light is the way in which I see. And with light, I can see the exact same thing in a radically new way. So it says, once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. Anyone here ever come to Alcoholics Anonymous, have a look at that fifth step and think, oh boy, I bet I'll be delighted after that. I know I didn't, you know, I did not think the result of that sort of action would be delight. Are you kidding me? Absolutely not. But that has been my experience. And it says we can look the world in the eye. And the reason is, you know, when I got here, when my life is in my hands, man, I am worse than you. I am less than you. You know, I have this feeling of who I am is not enough. But as I begin to rely upon God, I experience true humility. I'm no better than you. I'm no worse than you. And for somebody like me, I'm fully dependent upon God. And it says we can be alone at perfect peace and ease. And I have this whole big book bounce around I do with loneliness. But what I want to say is loneliness has nothing to do with physical proximity to another human being. It has everything to do with my connection with God. Everything. You can test that theory, because you can ask yourself, is it true? Have I ever felt absolutely, utterly lonely and alone in a stadium full of people? Have I ever felt absolutely, utterly lonely and alone in a room full of others? Heck, even a room full of other alcoholics. Have I ever felt absolutely, utterly lonely and alone in the middle of a relationship? And have I ever felt absolutely, utterly lonely and alone in the middle of an act of intimacy? Because all of those have been my experience. And heck, you know what's true? In my hands, I'm experiencing loneliness. You know what my best idea is? Isolate. You know what I mean? That's the best thing that I can come up with, which is a good indication. You know, it's about that separateness from God. See, I begin to clear away the stuff inside of me that's blocking me from that power greater than myself. And now I can be alone at perfect peace and ease. In the most incredible thing, it says our fears fall from us. Fall from us. Man, that means I didn't do it. That I didn't overcome fear. I didn't kick my for any of my defects of character. I didn't kick procrastination in the butt. I didn't overcome anger. I didn't overcome selfishness or self-centeredness. It happens to me. I do the work and I put myself in a position and it happens to me. My fears fall from me. Man, this is how I begin to know that I'm being held. This is how I begin to know that I'm being cared for. It says we may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. Hey, on page 44, where we kick this whole thing off, it says, I need one of those or I'm going to drink again. I'm now beginning to have it. How do I have it? I work these steps as a way of life, like my life depends on it because it does. And it says the feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. And that's what I'm after. The removal of the mental obsession. Man, I don't have time to take us there because I got about 10 minutes left. Don't worry, I have 9 on the time, which is a miracle. Yeah, like if you're doubting the power of a God, I have an eye on the time. God is real. But I'll have a look at page 84. Have a look at the step 10 promises. Man, that insane thought that I have to take a drink, that gets removed contingent upon the actions getting to step 10 and the actions that I take today. And it says, we will feel that we are on the capital H broad highway, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. Hand in hand. Whose hands am I in? I'm in God's hands, hand in hand. I'm not doing this thing alone. And you know, in this book, when it talked about the broad highway and the spirit of the universe, we first saw that in step 2 in the chapter, we agnostics. I was talking about, like, hey, could I just believe that there could be a spirit of the universe? From there, I might be able to get on that broad highway, but now I'm there and I'm not walking this journey alone. I am safe and protected. Now, real quick, let's pop over. Let's turn the page to 76. If you didn't know what I mean by this, is about giving more and more of myself to God's hands, more of myself to the unconditional love that is God. Let's have a look at that 7-step prayer. It's the second full paragraph, and it says, when ready, we say something like this: my creator. To be created is to be made with love. Anything that I have ever created, other than the mess of my life and my act of alcoholism, but anything that I have ever created has been made with care and love and attention. I have been made with that. And it says, I am now willing that you should have all of me. Again, I'm giving more and more of myself to that unconditional love that is God. And it says, good and bad. See, the power of this, I don't have to get good to get God. I don't have to be perfect to get God. I'm not landed in the hands of a judgmental, punitive, angry God that I thought existed when I got here. No, I'm landing in the hands of a God that loves me. I'm landing in the hands of a God that wants a relationship with me. Not in spite of the worst things that I've ever done. You know, that stuff that I didn't even want to share in my fifth, the stuff that I wanted to die behind, the stuff that I was so ashamed of. But because of that, God wants all of me and is going to use all of me. Because it says, I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character. It is God that does the removing. I'm not in the defect removal business. I'm in the willingness business. But I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. See, I am here in step 3. I'm going to go work for God. I'm going to go help others. In step 7, take away anything and everything that is blocking me from you and from helping those around me. That's what gets removed. And it says, grant me strength as I go from here to do your bidding. We have then completed. Amen. We have then completed step 7. Now, where I want to pop us over to is on page 80. This is just a quick story on page 80. It's the 1, 2, 3, 4, 4th paragraph. You can tell I do a lot of counting. Fourth paragraph. And it's the story of a gentleman where he stole this money from a bitterly hated business rival. And then he used that to discredit the man. And so the harm done was more than the money stolen. The harm done was ruining this guy's reputation. And he had this feeling that what he needed to do was make that right. And what he was going to do was he was going to stand in front of the church and say exactly what he had done. But he wasn't sure if he should do it or not. You know, and at that time, the reason he was going to do it at church is because that's where everybody in the town would be. And, he couldn't put it on Facebook. It wasn't a thing. You know what I'm saying? Don't Facebook your men. I'm just going to throw that out there, too. Don't put a post on Facebook or Instagram. My bad, guys. That's not how we make an amends. But it says that 4th paragraph, after consulting with his wife and partner, he came to the conclusion that it was better to take those risks than stand before his creator guilty of such ruinous slander. He saw that he had to place the outcome in God's hands, or he would soon start drinking again. And all would be lost anyhow. See, as I approach the 9th step, man, I'll be honest. The 9th step, I don't want to do that. I don't like that. I'm afraid I'm going to be rejected. That's one of those biggest fears, right? But you see, I'm not in the results business anymore. Just like I'm not in defect removal. I need to leave the outcome in God's hands. And, you know, it talks about in 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens. You know what's unexpected? It goes well. Because I assume it's going to go awful. I'm going to assume that they'll never talk to me again and they'll call the police. I didn't even do a crime, but they'll call the police. You know, that's what I assume. But in 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens. It goes well. And even if it doesn't, it's water over the dam and it's okay. And I am okay when I leave the outcome in God's hands. You know, somebody like me, but I don't want to. What's going to happen? The truth is, it's the outcome's not even in my hands anyways. I can plan, I can try to control, but man, it doesn't work. But when I leave it in God's hands, it truly, my experience is, it is everything that it needed to be. Let's take a big old bounce to page 124. And we're going to be in the chapter, The Family Afterward. And page 124, man, I love this. Man, we got promises all over this book. And it says, we're at the second or the first full paragraph, right, where it says, Henry Ford once made a wise remark to the effect that experience is the thing of supreme value in life. That is what has value. My experience with my alcoholism and my experience with these 12 steps and my experience with the spiritual awakening or spiritual experience that is on offer, that has value. And it says, this is true only, which is annoying because I was kind of hoping it would be true if I didn't have to do any work. Now, this is true only if one is willing to turn the past to good account. We grow by our willingness to face and rectify errors and convert them into assets. How do I do that? Step 4, step 5, step 6, step 7, step 8, and 9. It says the alcoholic's past thus becomes the principal asset of the family, and frequently it's almost the only one. You know, that deep, dark secret, that thing that I wanted to die behind, that thing that I didn't want to tell anyone about, that dark past becomes my main asset, the thing that I get to use to help others, to be a gift and to be a blessing in their life, my main asset. Only if I'm willing to do this work that, let's be frank, I don't want to do. It doesn't look like a whole lot of fun. But then it becomes my main asset. And it says the painful past may be of infinite value. I can't put a limit on the value of the things that I've gone through to other families still struggling with their problem. We think each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not. You know, I owe Alcoholics Anonymous a debt. And it's a debt that nobody's going to ask me to collect, but it's also a debt that I can never repay. Because the more that I try to repay that debt, man, the more that I receive, more than anything I could have ever imagined. And it says, and when the occasion requires, each member should be only too willing to bring out former mistakes, ours, not yours. You know, I'm bringing out my mistakes. I'm not pointing out other people's, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places, showing others who suffer how we were given help. The very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. Those bedevilments, I could not be of real use to other people. The feeling of uselessness, I was overrun by self-pity. Man, now I get to sit down with another alcoholic, book in hand, in my experience of the power of God, and say, yes, I went through that. Yes, I experienced that. Yes, I felt that way. Yes, I did that thing. Yes, that happened to me. Here's how we get freedom from it. That has given my life meaning and purpose beyond anything I could have ever imagined. And it says, cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. Now, did I say page 124 was one of my favorite promises? Look at me lying or not lying. I just got a whole lot of favorites. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to wrap up with one of my other favorite promises, is page 100. It's in the chapter Working with Others. And man, I love this. And it's working with others. See, I work these steps. I begin to clear away the stuff inside of me that's blocking. I make my past right. I continue to grow in effectiveness and understanding of God's will for me. I continue to keep that path, that channel clear. And I work with others. I work with others like my life depends on it, because it does. I take them through this book for somebody like me. I take them through these steps for somebody like me. I take them through this book. And it says, both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. That means I'm doing this thing on a daily basis. And also, I always want to emphasize, it is spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection, not progress rather than perfection. It is, how am I progressing spiritually? Because I can't stay sober based on the new car, the new relationship, getting my family back, you know, the new job, the new whatever. I can only stay sober contingent upon my relationship with God. Oh, man, there's another point in the book I want to go. I'm going to be 2 minutes over. I'll make amends. I'm so sorry. Let's real quickly, mid tangent, pop to page 120. Page 120. And we're in the chapter Two Wives, and there's not many places where we are given direction on what to do after we have relapsed, once we come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And what we're doing is, it's page 120, first full paragraph, where it talks about the alcoholic relapsing. I'm not going to read all of it, but I'm going to direct our attention to a direction. The alcoholic hasn't kept up the spiritual actions, and in this case, relapse. And it says, your husband, the alcoholic, will see at once that he must redouble his spiritual activities if he expects to survive. See, before I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, there's one reason for a relapse. the inevitability of that first drink, page 37, I will drink again. But after I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, there's one other, and that is a failure to grow spiritually. Man, I couldn't stay well on one drink. You know what I mean? There's nothing worse than giving me one drink and telling me to stop. Ah, taking away all the booze in the house. Ah, kill me. I can't stay well on one experience. I need to continue to grow. And then at the bottom, the very, very, very bottom of the page, it talks about if he gets drunk, do not blame yourself. God has either removed your husband's liquor problem or he has not. How does that happen? Me working through these 12 steps and I receive the gift. If not, it had better been found out right away. Then your husband can get right down to fundamentals. What are the fundamentals? The actions of these 12 steps taken out of this book. That's what I need to do. That's it. That's what the fundamentals are. And it says, if a repetition is to be prevented, place the problem along with everything else in God's hands. In God's hands, not in my hands. Right? I'm no longer in the outcome business. And you know, in step three, when I'm trying to wrest satisfaction and happiness, you know, I get to rest, not with a W, but with an R. I get to rest in God. So going back to page 100, I'm working with others. I'm carrying this message. This is what resting in God, this is the peace and serenity looks like. It says, if you persist, remarkable things will happen. Man, this is our experience, remarkable. It says, when we look back, we realize the things which came to us. When we put ourselves in God's hands, we're better than anything we could have planned. That is a promise. And it says, follow the dictates. Man, I don't like dictates. Don't tell me what to do. Follow the steps. Just do the steps. The dictates of a capital H, capital P, higher power. And you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. So for anyone that is new, for anyone that has been in and out of this thing for a while, for anyone here today, the magic has not happened, or maybe the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous has worn off and you have problems that are piling up on you. Man, what I want to do is I want to invite you into that new and wonderful world. Our life depends on helping you. Our life depends on helping you take these steps. And it does not take long to get well. It does not take long to have a spiritual awakening. Thank you.